I was given a copy of Thomas Harris's brilliant thriller, Silence of the Lambs, long before it appeared in England or the film had been released. It was a present from the Appalachian crime writer Sharon McCrum, a sort of thank you for letting her base the seedy ex-academic tour guide murderer Rowan Rover in her Missing Susan on a recognisable caricature of my good self. But it was about Harris's other creation that Sharon wrote to me specifically, James Gumb, Buffalo Bill, the serial murderer who skins his humps. This was seen as a brilliant psychological study of a serial murderer, she told me. What did I think? I read the book and replied that while the work as a whole was a wonderfully tense thriller, with good and dense characterization by the standards of the genre, I didn't see Buffalo Bill as a profound psychological study. But I did see him as a criminal fascinatingly created from bits and pieces of other men's famous crimes. Ted Bundy's ploy for snaring victims. Chris Wilder's use of videos and non-pornographic television to turn himself on before starting to torture. Ed Kemper's adolescent approach to difficult grandparents. Leonard Lake's notion of adult playrooms. Oddly enough, Gum's sophisticated stitchcraft and extravagantly camp queening pushed Ed Gein back into a minor place in my mind, just as Dr. Hannibal Lecter's beautifully realized good taste and cerebral superiority clouded all memories of America's best-known cannibal, Albert Fish. It was the snippety details from famous killers that caught the mind, rather than big general portraits. The obsessive recollection and glamorization of the mom who abandoned her infant son, suggesting Charles Manson. The deposit of a rare pupa as a signature in each victim's throat, culminating in the sinister death's head moth, recalling the Zodiac Killer's bizarre calling cards. Oh yes, Silence of the Lambs meant paying a lot of mental visits to a lot of old friends. I wonder whether you remember them all. You remember the scene in the movie where Buffalo Bill traps Senator Martin's plump daughter? She's about to re-enter her flat when she sees him struggling to push a small sofa into the back of his van. As she peers through the darkness, she realizes that he's having immense difficulty because his right arm is in plaster. So she charitably goes over and helps, accepts his grunted request that she pull the front end up into the van. And there he slugs her and secures her and makes off with his prey. A shiver ran through a million American spines then, as they recognized the kidnapping methods of one of their great nightmares, Ted Bundy. Bundy evokes a reaction among the respectable middle class of America that seems out of all proportion to his crimes and abilities. He's likely to be described as brilliant, whereas his college grades and the batteries of tests he took showed him to be intelligent and articulate, but not a real high flyer. He succeeded in maintaining good A and B grades when he read psychology, but fell back significantly when he transferred to law. His previous schooling showed no especially remarkable ability. IQ tests, for what they're worth, set him at 124, comfortably above average, but not likely to make an outstanding mark by brains alone. As for his criminal standing, well, I was deeply surprised when a clean-cut, healthy and successful young American businessman, taking his two sons on a guided walk around London, asked me whether I didn't think Bundy was the most evil of all murderers. Frankly, I'd never even put him in the top 10th percentile for evil. A brutal and alarming rapist, using his wits to lure young women into his car. A murderer with the frightening and unusual habit of quietly creeping in and battering victims to death in their beds. A liar who used manipulative charm to try and persuade the world of his innocence, but not one who tried to get others to pay the penalty for his crimes like Christie, not a sadist who loved seeing the fear of his victims like Hansen, not a bundle of monstrous hobgoblin malignity like Charlie Peace, just an inadequate, driven man whose desperate need to see himself and be seen as a classic success got entangled with his attraction to beautiful, long-haired girls and his abominable need to possess them wholly. A man whose sadistic sexuality always seemed to maintain a chilly detachment, even from partners with whom he was close and affable before and after the act itself. I think the fear of Ted Bundy, springs from the remarkable way in which his good looks, stylish self-presentation, and conservative manners fit perfectly into a certain type of American dream. Bundy looked like the open, clean-cut, young Mr. Liberal Republican incarnate. And decent Republicans are accustomed to thinking that violence and brutality and lust are the prerogative of the sweaty underclasses. It's a deep shock to find that the tan cordovan shoes, clean corduroy trousers, English vented sports jacket, well-groomed hair, and slightly Briticized accent, always enunciating good grammar, may conceal a guy who bestially ravishes and slaughters at least 18, possibly, as he once seemed to imply, as many as 35 or 37 innocent young girls. But there, my good Christian Republican friends, isn't that the demonstration of original sin that you all believe in? If I can make myself search for and try to find that of God in Charles Manson, aren't you equally committed to believing that beneath the merciful protection of undeserved grace, you are really all Ted Bundys at heart? Of course, Ted Bundy wasn't born into a state of class and style. It really is unusual to find anyone who has been blessed with high advantages of birth and breeding, coupled with the intelligence and education to fully appreciate the finer things of life, deciding that ecstasy lies in battering a beautiful head to a pulp. Indeed, apart from very rare mad aristocrats like Gilles de Rais, I can't think of any examples. Ted Bundy was born illegitimate in 1946, and like Charlie Manson and David Berkowitz, seems to have felt that this cast a stigma on him. His family didn't really help by trying to cover the fact from him, and half pretending that he was his mother's little brother. It wasn't a deception that could work, especially when his mother moved from the East Coast to the Northwest, and he was taken out of the care of his grandparents, whom he had come to see as the stable pillars of his family life. Nor did changing his surname 3 times before he was 6 years old exactly engender a sense of secure identity. When his mother finally married Mr. Bundy, a very decent man who happily accepted little Theodore as his son, little Ted didn't really like the social point at which he had been brought to rest. For inescapably he had to accept that he was now of the respectable working class. Sometimes he would have to go out and help Mr. Bundy pick beans after work to contribute a few extra dollars to the family income. All the time he noticed with distaste that his family drove a cheap old car. Ted was early sure that those who counted drove new expensive vehicles, and like most young males, he wanted to count. His mother saw him as the brightest of her children and expected that higher education would lead Ted on to great things. He didn't achieve anything very impressive in his first period at Washington State University, but he did win a prestigious girlfriend. Stephanie Brooks was a Californian from a wealthy family. An out-of-state student, she was, perhaps, a cut above the straightforward home students from the Seattle neighborhood. Bundy went skiing with her and improved his own sense of class, learning to discriminate between good wines and adopting the stylish Briticisms which marked his use of language. When Stephanie graduated and returned to California, Bundy determined to follow her. He had decided to study Chinese, as he felt that the massive importance of China internationally would make that a good basis for a public career. He hoped to go to Stanford, a more prestigious university than Washington State. In preparation, he went down to California to be near Stephanie. It was a disaster. Seeing Ted in the context of her home and family, Stephanie realized it would never work. What seemed stylish and reasonably classy in the context of the Northwestern campus seemed merely gauche, immature, and aspiring among the well-bred Brookses. As kindly as possible, she told Ted it had just been an undergraduate thing. It was over. They were not engaged. He was free. Bundy was overwhelmed. His dream of himself as the husband of this beautiful, long-haired mate collapsed. He dropped out of school and sank to various forms of menial work, waiting at a cheap restaurant, humping crates as a warehouse man. Later, he would see this as the lowest point of his life, an estimate few of us would endorse, given the criminal brutality to which he sank a few years later. Still, he had some of the resilience of youth, and he pulled himself up off the floor through the means of politics. Massively organized American election campaigns need a lot of supportive manpower, and Bundy was hired as a roadie for a popular black Republican's attempt to win the lieutenant governorship of Washington State. Two things immediately show up. First, Bundy had placed himself at a most effective point on the political spectrum to appeal widely. He was a Republican, and so conservative-minded. He had always strenuously opposed the anti-Vietnam War hippies, saying that their demonstrations and disruptions would produce mere anarchy. On the other hand, he was supporting a black candidate, and so nobody could suggest that his conservatism was embittered, snobbish, racist, elitist, or uncaring. He had always told the hippies he agreed with their aim of stopping the war, but thought they were going about it the wrong way. In fact, as a classic manipulator, Bundy had found a role in which he could confidently say things he knew any given auditor wanted to hear, knowing that in return he would be persuading that auditor to think well of him. The second point about politics was that it brought Bundy safely close to style, class, and wealth. The candidates and big fixers assiduously cultivated men and women of wealth and influence. They introduced their humble campaign workers to them. And in a democratic situation, nobody ever dared to look askance at the class origins of a party worker, even if they sometimes showed incongruously like a trailing petticoat. Bundy could mingle with the mighty, unembarrassed by the fear of a repeat rejection such as he had experienced in California. Although Bundy's candidate lost his election, and the Republicans for Rockefeller, whom Bundy supported, overwhelmingly failed to get their man the presidential nomination, Bundy had his foot well in Republican state politics. A humble party worker, yes, but one who had proved himself reliable, and who earned occasional invitations to posh junketings both in and out of state. By the time he had worked for a candidate who successfully retained his post as state governor, Bundy was a promising party worker, offered favors and support by men with real local power. He dressed smartly in three-piece suits. His strangely anonymous and chameleon good looks began to take on an air of mature prosperity which he would never again enjoy. He seemed to be a good little yuppie on his way yup, a young fogey who had found his niche. His private life, too, entered what should have been a period of complete stability. Through Republican Party functions, he met Meg Anders, the daughter of a prosperous and influential family, whose siblings held weighty professional positions in Utah. Meg was on the verge of divorce. The handsome charmer came into her life at a time when she needed support, and for the next 4 years, Bundy was to be her lover and surrogate father to her daughter. His next move was not silly either. He decided to use his influential contacts to improve his mediocre academic record. He went back to college, with recommendations from the state governor and his staff, to study psychology. It was the one period of his life when he performed well academically. His professors thought very highly indeed of him. He also took night work as a counselor with Crisis Call, an equivalent of Telephone Samaritans. He was very good at this work. His manipulative chameleon personality obviously suited him well to quickly inspiring confidence in the distressed. It was second nature to Ted to listen with an inner ear for what people wanted of him and feed it back to them quickly. It was while engaged on this work that he won the friendship of true crime writer Anne Rule, a friendship which would lead her into the extraordinary situation of finding that she was contracted to write a book about a series of unsolved murders, only to find it increasingly apparent as the investigation unraveled that the slayer was her charming friend and fellow counselor, Ted Bundy. But that stage had not arrived yet. On the surface, Bundy's life was running well on sensibly organized lines. On the surface. Underneath, things were not so bright. He was not faithful to Meg Anders, although she adored him, and the understanding was that the two would certainly be getting married. Their sex life started to deteriorate. He became more and more impersonal, also less and less interested in sexual relations at all. He tried to pep things up with bondage, tying her up with pantyhose before pretending to rape her. She did not enjoy this, but that didn't stop him. remarkable evidence at the deep cutting edge of the extent to which his quick empathy with others was only a shallow, manipulative reaction to be used for his own interests, and not a genuine sensitive capacity to relate to them. On the third occasion they played this game, he went into a kind of trance and started pressing his forearm lethally across her throat. Fortunately, he ejaculated and came out of the trance before any harm was done, but Meg wisely never let him tie her up again. Another lover at the same period later reported that he'd once started throttling her as they made love. Bundy was to claim that reading pornography had led him into perverse practices, with the innuendo that wicked purveyors of filth had corrupted him against his own better nature, and so, perhaps, he should not be blamed if violent crimes had been committed. Certainly, police told Anne Rule that they found filthy literature in his room. Yet Bundy told her that this was nothing more than Alex Comfort's The Joys of Sex, a harmlessly sophisticated bedroom manual to be found in a million respectable middle-class bookshelves. Anne believed that naive cops had indeed taken this as a shockingly dirty book. But I don't think we can assess the truth of this either way. Bundy was such a manipulative liar that he would certainly want the straight and narrowly virtuous to think that other pornographic publishing abusers of the First Amendment had misled him, whereas he would certainly not want his decent and intelligent friend Anne to think that he pored over grubby, sadomasochistic mags. I don't know which of these two useful stories, directed at different audiences, really represents the truth. But another vital thing that neither Anne nor Meg knew was that Stephanie had returned to his life. Meeting him again in 1973, she had been amazed by the transformation from gauche college kid into mature young political aide on the way up. This was a man she could relate to. This was a man she could marry, and they were engaged. She knew nothing about Meg. Meg knew nothing about her. Both assumed they would be marrying Ted soon. Stephanie was quickly disillusioned. It seems that Ted's reconciliation with her was nothing but a self-gratifying power play. Once she was safely hooked, and he had restored the self-esteem so badly damaged by her rejection of him 3 years earlier, he dropped her like a hot brick. He didn't answer her letters. He put the phone down on her when she called him. He let her break it off for a second time. Convinced, like some childish teenager, that he'd won this round. He was the one who really issued the brush. Yet within a week of that squalid triumph, his criminal career began. In December 1973, a young girl named Sharon Clark was found battered in her bed. She was alive, but her skull was fractured, her bedclothes were covered with blood. An unknown intruder had broken into her room and attacked her as she slept. On the 31st of January 1974, student Linda Ann Healy actually disappeared from her bed. The bloodstains over her sheets and the bloody nightdress in her closet showed that the intruder had first battered her, possibly killing her, and then, quite extraordinarily, had stolen the body. On the 12th of March, Donna Gail Manson disappeared as she was going to a concert at her college, Evergreen State, in Olympia, Washington. On the 17th, Susan Rancourt disappeared on her way from Central Washington State College to go to a movie. On the 6th of May, Roberta Kathleen Parks disappeared while taking a late-night walk at Oregon State University, Corvallis. On the 1st of June, Brenda Ball vanished near Seattle Airport. The 11th of June, George Ann Hawking vanished from the University of Washington. The Northwest was suffering from an abductor and probably a murderer of beautiful young girls with long hair. Clues came with the disappearance of Janice Ott from Lake Samanish Park. Passers-by had noticed a young man with his arm in a sling introduce himself to her as Ted and ask if she would help him load a sailboat onto the roof of his car. When that was reported, Doris Grayling informed police that earlier that afternoon she'd gone with a similar young man in a sling to help him lift his boat, but she had backed off when they came to the car, and he said the boat was at his house and asked her to drive there with him. And this story produced other stories of a young man in a sling, in Seattle, and on the college campuses where women had been abducted. A young man who had tended to drop his briefcase or books and graciously accept offers of help from the beautiful, long-haired girls who just happened to be passing by at the time. Those who had restricted or refused their help, especially when asked to get in the car and help him test the ignition, said he drove a brown Volkswagen from which the front passenger seat had been removed. An artist's impression of the witness descriptions was issued. It was a dead ringer for Ted Bundy. He drove a brown VW. Four people, including Meg Anders and Anne Rule, went through a hideous crisis of conscience. It couldn't be Ted who was carrying out the Northwest killing, yet he fitted. In the end, four people gave his name to police. Where it joined the names of 2,000 others, reported by an anxious and helpful public, and sank without trace to the bottom of the computer. By September, the bodies started turning up. Parts of Janice Ott and Denise Nasland, who had been kidnapped the same day at Lake Salmonish, were found in thick undergrowth a few miles away. The killer had enjoyed two women at once. Yet the killings and abductions had stopped. Oh, well. By sheer coincidence, Ted Bundy had left Washington State and gone to Utah. He had decided to study law at the University of Utah. It was close to Meg Anders' family. With recommendations from the Washington governor's office, he got his placing easily, and he embarked as a law student. I met his University of Utah roommate a couple of years ago. He told me Bundy was a nice guy, but a poor student. For Ted's phase of academic excellence was over. But in Utah, the disappearances started again. Melissa Smith, daughter of the police chief of Midvale, disappeared 18th of October. Her raped and strangled body was found in the mountains a week later. 31st of October, Laura Amy disappeared. In November, Bundy made a mistake. Presenting himself as a plainclothes police officer, he told Carol Daronch that somebody had attempted to break into her car in a shopping center car park. She agreed to go with him to the police station in his car, but struggled and resisted when he snapped handcuffs on her. Her struggle led him to snap both cuffs on one wrist. When he pulled a gun, she tumbled out of the car. When he brought a crowbar down over her head, she held it off by main force and kicked him hard in the balls before running screaming into traffic to be rescued by a passing motorist. A victim had escaped and would be able to identify Bundy. He switched his activities to Colorado for the time being, killing at least four more women. If the bodies were found early enough, there was usually evidence that they had been sexually assaulted, as well as battered or strangled. It was also becoming increasingly clear that this abductor had an amazing capacity to make young women disappear in startlingly short stretches of unpopulated road or corridor, and in tiny intervals of time. And at last, on the 15th of August, 1975, Bundy was picked up. Not for murder, for bad driving. A police patrol car spotted his VW weaving erratically through the night and signalled him to pull over. When Bundy hightailed it instead, a short chase ensued, which Bundy lost. Inside the car, the patrolman found what he took to be a burglar's equipment, a ski mask, a mask made from pantyhose with the legs tied together and eye holes cut in it, an ice pick and a crowbar. Bundy scoffed at them. Didn't everyone own an ice pick and a crowbar? Of course he had a ski mask. He'd been skiing ever since he first went to college. The pantyhose mask was his own invention to wear under the ski mask to stop the wool from chafing. But, with Bundy in for questioning, with his car searched, and hairs similar to those of Utah victim Melissa Smith discovered, with maps of bountiful Colorado where women were disappearing in the glove compartment, Bundy was suddenly in the frame as the Northwest murderer. He was tried and convicted for the kidnapping of Carol Daronch, despite his plea that she was out and about, so nobody had kidnapped her. He drew a 1-to-5-year sentence, and would probably have been free in 15 months if that had been all that stood against him. But he had yet to face trial in Colorado. He insisted that he was innocent of any murder. There was only circumstantial evidence. He had been the victim of a series of cruel coincidences. He was so clean-cut, so articulate, so persuasive, that even those who had informed the police about him were in constant doubt. Meg Anders broke off with him because he started running a new secret girlfriend in Utah and Colorado, and she could not take any more of his deceit. But like Anne Lane, she seems for a remarkably long time to have been like Sir Bedivere, this way and that dividing the swift mind, as she thought about his guilt or innocence. In Aspen, Colorado, Bundy enjoyed a couple of weeks as a romantic local hero. He had typically got the best of both worlds, firing his court-appointed lawyers and insisting on defending himself, yet compulsorily retaining their services as legal advisers. So he was allowed to work in the courtroom law library in the intervals of the trial, yet his sacked lawyers could still make submissions on his behalf. One was doing so at the moment when Bundy realized he was now unsupervised in the library. He dropped 30 feet from a window and sprinted away into the crowd. His sacked lawyer said with wry wit that Bundy's escape was the strongest vote of no confidence in the argument he was advancing at that moment that could be imagined. Bundy was retaken in 8 days. It was winter in Colorado, and he got himself stuck in the mountains without transport. When he returned to a hunting cabin he had robbed once, police were waiting for him, and he went back to trial. In future, his legs would be fettered and his hands cuffed when he worked in the library. Yet he managed a further escape, this time from prison. He observed that the light fitting in his cell was mounted on a largish square panel. He complained vociferously about prison food to disguise the fact that he was actually dieting to slim himself down to a size that would get through the panel. From an unknown source, he obtained a hacksaw blade and established that nobody noticed once he had made the panel removable. He explored the crawlway over the ceiling and found that it brought him to a hatch in a prison guard's apartment. He waited for a night when that guard was out at the movies and made his escape. He left a bundle like himself under a blanket and got a 17-hour start before his absence was noticed. He went from Chicago to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and wondered about settling on the University of Michigan campus. But it was winter, and by his own account, he decided to run for the sun in Florida. Others have wondered whether a subconscious wish for maximum drama or a hidden death wish led him to flee to one of the few eastern states that retained the death penalty. His escape had been well pre-planned. He had a small stash of money and ID papers in 4 different names. He settled in Tallahassee, Florida, using the name Chris Hagen. He told people he met that he'd been a law student in Utah and left them to assume that he'd transferred to the University of Florida. Actually, he was living off stolen credit cards and driving stolen cars. The campus at Tallahassee was smaller than the others where he had lived. When he started killing, within a week of his arrival, it had to be almost on his own doorstep. On the 15th of January, 1978, an intruder armed with an oak log broke into Chi Omega Sorority House. In the first bedroom he entered, Karen Chandler and Kathy Kleiner were sleeping. Both were savagely battered with the log. The room was covered with blood and fragments of bark. Leaving them for dead, the man went to the next room, where he battered and sexually abused Lisa Levy and Margaret Bowman, strangling the latter with a new pair of pantyhose he had apparently bought for the purpose. Both were dead. Karen Chandler and Kathy Kleiner survived, though both required hospital treatment, and the latter's jaw was broken and her teeth permanently loosened. But Bundy was not yet satiated. On the way back home, he saw another basement bedroom with an open window, and slipping in, he battered dance student Cheryl Thomas, leaving her with broken legs and a fractured skull, her balance permanently damaged, so that she could not continue her career as a dancer. Early in February, he stole a van from campus and replaced its number plate with one he had stolen from a student's car. He drove it to Pensacola, where he forcibly abducted 12-year-old Kimberly Leach. Her body was found later. She'd been strangled and violently assaulted sexually. But again, Bundy had made a bad mistake. An earlier attempt to abduct a young girl in Jacksonville had been interrupted by her older brother. He had taken the number of the stolen van and passed it to the police, who were now alerted to pick up this vehicle with false number plates. 3 days later, Bundy was arrested in Pensacola and would never again leave prison. He defended himself, apparently reveling in the praise he won from the judge for his legal skill, and believing that he was proving himself a better lawyer than the professionals. Actually, this national showing off, which earned him the loathing of most middle-class Americans, may well have cost him his life. An insanity plea might just have got somewhere. A blanket claim that he didn't do it and was only trapped by misleading circumstantial evidence collapsed because of his bestial ferocity with Linda Levy. He had bitten her right nipple almost off so that it hung by a thread of tissue. He had jammed a hairspray bottle into her vagina, tearing the perineum and bruising the rectum. But he had also savagely bitten her buttocks, leaving lacerated double rows of tooth marks. Many people have seen pictures of the studious, lawyerly Bundy examining photographs of those marks with a disapproving expression, as though this was some sort of mysterious frame-up. Less well known is that he was held down kicking and screaming for his toothprints to be taken by a dentist. They matched the injuries to Lisa. And after a decade of playing at being the world's best-known jailhouse lawyer, Bundy was executed. The women who cheered outside the execution chamber when they knew he was dead might seem inhumane, but their rage was rightly directed. Bundy certainly hated and feared them as women, and would willingly have killed and ravished any he found attracting him. It was wise of Thomas Harris to restrict his use of Bundy as a model for Buffalo Bill. We can take and detest his exploitation of his victims' kindness to lure them into his car. We find it too disturbing to think that a short-haired, neatly dressed Mr. Clean, such as we'd all like our own sons to be, might turn out to be a vicious mass of seething lust and cruelty. Didn't really get into the movie, but early hints that Thomas Harris based Buffalo Bill on more than one or two serial murderers came in the book Silence of the Lambs. as Dr. Hannibal Lecter, in his secure cell, mused on the last session of his last victim, the musician Raspail, the one who had told him all about Jame Gumb. Jame had the most atrocious room imaginable in the San Francisco flophouse, Lecter recalls Raspail saying. Sort of aubergine walls with smears of psychedelic day glow here and there from the hippie years. Terribly battered everything. Of course, that instantly calls to mind David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam murderer, whose apartment was found to be a sort of Satanist's rat's nest, with offensive verses and letters on pieces of paper lying around, and threatening slogans in magic marker on the walls. Those who have read Maury Terry's study of the case, however, will remember that a couple of weeks before his arrest, Berkowitz's room had been perfectly clean and well furnished. They will know that there is now a strong suspicion that Berkowitz and others deliberately desecrated it when it had been decided that Berkowitz was to be the fall guy for more murders than he'd actually committed. And so, his rooms were turned into the familiar mess of physical demoralization found when so many murderers have been run down. But another of Dr. Lecter's recollections rings a still more specific bell. "I mean, he killed his grandparents when he was 12, Raspail had observed. "Aha, did he now?" The crime historian picks up that reference pretty quickly. For there is a modern serial killer who was sent to stay with his grandparents when he was 14, despite his mother's warning that he was a potential murderer and the old people wouldn't be safe, as they weren't. For Ed Kemper killed them as a sort of antipasta to the spree of slaying that marked his young adult life. Ed was born in 1948. His mother appears to have been the bane of his life, an able, determined, competent, but fiercely dominating woman. She soon split up with his father, and thereafter henpecked any other men who tried to live with her. Ed became the object of her constant, withering scorn, and it made him shy and uneasy in any company, fearful, like mass murderer Charles Starkweather, that other kids were mocking him, afraid to express affection for those whom he did like. Once, his little sister said to him that he should kiss his teacher. "I'd have to kill her before I could kiss her," the child replied. Prophetic. He was to grow up into a man who did indeed have to kill before he could kiss. A man like British multiple murderer Christie, who found sex easiest, maybe only possible, with a dead partner. And since he didn't work in a mortuary, he would have to create his own partners. But sadistic tendencies were apparent in young Ed long before he found his métier. His little sister encountered them first, vicariously, thank goodness. Ed introduced her to the interesting game of cutting her dolly's hands and feet and head off. Oh, well, I suppose lots of kids have played the more boring version of Doctors and Nurses that entails finding out what's in Teddy's tummy, rather than the interesting variants that entail a more personal examination. Not many, on the other hand, have played out masochistic fantasies in which their little sisters enact letting them die in gas chambers. That was another of little Ed's games. Then he took the dangerous step beyond fantasy and imaginative play. He moved to reality, fortunately killing the cat and cutting it up, rather than little sister. He was caught with pieces of puss in the wardrobe, and Mama Kemper had good reason for shrieking that her son was a demented weirdo. When he was 13, Ed could take no more of Mama's shrieking. He ran away to his father, a sensible move for a lad who was clearly growing up to be very tall, and whose healthy enthusiasms were all macho and outdoorsy and connected with the Boy Scouts and the cult of John Wayne. Unfortunately, his father could not cope with him single-handed, and it was arranged that the boy should go to live with his paternal grandparents on their ranch in Northern California. Mama Kemper telephoned her ex to shrill at him that this was not a good idea. "You might wake up one day and find they've been killed," she shouted. Alas, that she was such a shrew. Mr. Kemper paid no attention to this typical piece of interfering nagging, which was a pity. Mama Kemper was a bad wife and mother, but a rather good prophet. In August 1963, young Ed decided he could do without a ticking off from his grandmother. By his own account, it occurred to him, quite calmly and dispassionately, to wonder what she would look like dead. So he took a rifle down from the wall and blew her head off to find out. Since there was still time to fill in before Grandad came home, he idly picked up a knife and devoted the remainder of the afternoon to stabbing the old lady's body. When his grandfather arrived, Ed decided against giving them both the distress that the discovery of Grandma's body must have occasioned. Instead, he took the trusty rifle and gunned down Grandad as he stood on his own doorstep. Then, like a good little responsible boy scout, he telephoned his mother to advise her of the situation and sat down to wait for the law to come and take him away. He was found to be insane and sent to Atascadero State Hospital, where he spent the next 5 years under treatment. In 1969, he ceased to be a juvenile. Rather than lock him up somewhere more severe, the authorities adjudged him cured, and he was released into the custody of the state's attorney. And at this point, the often despised psychiatrists, who have given such dreadful and contradictory advice and opinions in so many murder cases, really got one right. They urgently advised that if Ed must be returned to the community, he should not under any circumstances be allowed to live with his mother. Did the state's attorney pay a blind bit of attention? He did not. Ed was sent straight back to Mama, by now a successful administrative assistant in a college at Santa Cruz. There was a deep shock awaiting anyone who thought of Ed as the little boy who had so unfortunately killed his grandparents. He had grown up into a real giant, 6'9" tall, towering over absolutely everyone he met, but a gentle giant withal. One who was no match for his mother's nagging and rages. For these continued ceaselessly. Mrs. Kemper humiliated her son incessantly, putting him down in front of his friends and hers, driving him to a beetroot-red figure of shambling, fumbling shame and embarrassment and rage. Ed was useless. Ed couldn't get a decent job. Ed was living off her. Why couldn't Ed do something with the brain God gave him? For Ed was not stupid. Batteries of tests in the mental hospital had established that he had an IQ of 136. Now, that really is quite decently high. As measured by the shrinks, Ed Kemper was markedly more intelligent than Ted Bundy. Yet, where Bundy could be said to have pushed his upper second-class brain to the limit, getting good grades in psychology, and ultimately putting up a good simulation of forensic skill in defending his life unsuccessfully, Ed never managed to become anything more impressive than a flagman for the district roadworks. He hoped to be a policeman. Well, I guess his having spent his adolescence in a mental hospital after murdering his grandparents didn't bode well for his chances. But his feelings were spared by the suggestion that it was really his height was against him. The cops might know Ed would never do anyone any harm, but the feelings of Joe Citizen might be a little different if something the size of a giraffe came bearing down in uniform. Ed became a police hanger-on, a welcome figure dropping in for a chat at the local station, and a friend known by name to most of his neighbourhood law enforcement officers. Ed got around the place on a motorbike until it crashed. He bought another. That crashed too. But Ed, as I've said, was not stupid. Serial murderers, by the way, rarely are. Ann Rule's belief that Ted Bundy was unusually intelligent in their number is misplaced. He was unusual in managing to look as though his good brain had satisfactory and stimulating sustenance through his crisis counselling work. But he was actually like his peers in having under-entertained his little grey cells, under-exercised them, so that he could not find mental fulfilment, and then resented the fact that he did not enjoy public rewards and esteem compatible with his nascent but undeveloped potential. This seems to be quite a common pattern in such men. No, Ed Kemper was not stupid. He had insured his bikes well, and after the two crashes, had made sufficient profit on his claims to buy a car. Now he was set up for a career in which he could pick up women. During 1970 and 1971, the gentle giant got in the habit of picking up girl hitchhikers. He was especially interested in the girl students of the Santa Cruz campus of the University of California. 7th of May, 1972, he picked up Anita Lucchese and Mary Ann Pesky. He did what he called a few loopy-loops, confusing them as to their whereabouts by circling and twisting around the spaghetti with which Southern California has proved experimentally that building a perfect road system at great expense merely worsens your traffic problem and lowers the quality of living. Then he stopped at a quiet spot, produced a gun, and locked Anita in the boot. He handcuffed Mary Ann Pesquet and put a plastic bag over her head. She bravely and sensibly tried to talk him into reason, but he was far gone in lust and madness. He stabbed her, first in the body, then in the throat. This excited him. So he opened the boot and stabbed Anita Lucchese over and over and over again. Then he drove the bodies home, abused them sexually, and cut them up. He buried them out on the mountains a couple of days later, but kept the heads in his wardrobe a little longer. Ed liked mementos. In September, he picked up Aiko Ku on her way to a dance class. He loopy-looped her to the mountains, taped her mouth, and suffocated her by shoving his fingers up her nostrils. Her struggles excited him, and as soon as she was dead, he raped the body, enjoying a speedy and successful climax. Then he took her back home and cut off her head and hands. Decapitating the corpse excited him all over again. Later he buried the remains out above Boulder Creek. In January 1973, he seized Cynthia Schall and drove her to a back road near the ironically named township of Freedom. There he held her with a gun, amusing himself from time to time by assuring her that he would not harm her. Then he shot her, drove her home, and hid her in the wardrobe while his mother was around, and the following day amused himself with necrophiliac practices. Then he chopped it up with an axe, put it in plastic bags, and dumped it off some cliffs where it was found a day later. California knew it had a co-ed killer on its hands, a sadistic serial murderer drawing his victims from the local population of girl college students. They hadn't a clue who he was, but he proved himself still active on February the 5th. Once again, Ed took two victims at once. Rosalind Thorpe was grabbed as she came out of a lecture. Alice Louis a little after. He shot them both in the head and carried the bodies home in the boot of his car. As his mother was in, he couldn't take them up to his room immediately, but he couldn't resist the gratification of cutting off the heads at once. The following day, he took them up to the bathroom, cleaned the bodies up, and ravished Alice Louise's headless cadaver. Then he dumped heads and bodies in different places. On Easter Sunday, he committed the crime that really should have been his first. At any rate, it might have saved several young lives had Mrs. Kemper been killed at the outset. Anyway, in the morning, before she had arisen, Ed went into his mother's bedroom and battered her with a hammer. Then he took out the big knife he nicknamed the General and cut her head off. He put the head on the mantelpiece and aimlessly threw a few darts at it before stowing the body away in a closet. He felt a bit sick. He'd just terminated the stormiest but strongest relationship in his life. He'd also undercut the financial support, which would always, in the end, make up for his poor earning power. He might, he felt, have killed himself, had he not, by good luck, going out for a drive, come across an acquaintance who owed him $10 and immediately offered to repay him. But still, Ed felt that there was somehow something incomplete. So he telephoned Sarah Hallett, a friend of his mother's, and invited her over for dinner with him and his mother. She arrived a little late and hurried in, saying, "Let's sit down, I'm dead." This seemed prophetic. So Ed hit her and strangled her, his gigantic hands breaking her neck in the process. He declared his newfound independent manhood by sleeping in his mother's bed that night. Next day, he took the money from Mrs. Hallett's handbag and drove aimlessly away in her car, stopping at one point to change into a rented Hertz car. He drove to Colorado, where a cop flagged him down. Ed assumed the bodies had been found and he was being arrested. To his amazement, he was wrong. He merely received an instant $25 fine for speeding. He drove around for 3 days, expecting the authorities to do their duty and arrest him. It didn't happen. So he telephoned Santa Cruz police to confess to murdering his mother and turn himself in. They didn't take him seriously. Good old Ed couldn't be a killer. He must be joking, in a horribly macabre way, but there you are. After several more calls, he persuaded them to go to the house, where his mother's head on the mantelpiece was no joke. Pueblo, Colorado police picked Ed up, and the gentle giant was returned to Santa Cruz in handcuffs, where press photographers found him, like David Berkowitz, smiling with apparent satisfaction at having reached his destination and his appointment with national infamy. Under arrest, and since in prison, he has proved amiable and cooperative with anyone who interviews him, happily giving details of his acts of necrophilia and claiming to have eaten parts of his victims. Murder satisfied some deep inner need in Ed Kemper. Now, if you ask me, his actions were in fact wickeder than Bundy's. While Ted Bundy might coincidentally frighten the living, who didn't know but that they might be suddenly battered in their own beds, his victims were rapidly swept into merciful oblivion, and the survivors can remember nothing of his assaults. Ed, by contrast, exploited his gentle manner to lure young women into trusting him, and then terrorized them with his loopy-loop driving, his production of a weapon in a lonely place, and, in at least a couple of cases, his protracted cat-and-mouse conversations in which he permitted the frightened women to believe they might yet emerge alive. His loathsome need to enjoy dead sexual partners might, with extreme understatement, be described as a misfortune for him as well as them. It wasn't, as far as the rest of us can judge, a calculating cruelty. But his actions prior to the murders were. And that puts him into the bracket of a little group of killers who are also fleetingly hinted at in Silence of the Lambs. A group we might designate the Hunters. The Hunters, of course, are not the only multiple murderers to win a passing reference from Thomas Harris. We've already seen that Jane Gumb's mother and his attitude to her links him tenuously to Charles Manson. Gumb also has the peculiar habit, beloved of crime fiction writers, but effectively unknown in real murderers, of leaving a cryptic calling card with each victim. In Gumb's case, it is the pupa of a rare moth, culminating in the death's head moth, which suddenly identifies him to Officer Starling as she interviews him in Mrs. Lippman's house. Now, any real-life criminal who did something so extraordinary as to place an unusual and necessarily hand-reared organism in his victim's throats would pretty certainly be arrested quite promptly. I can't bring to mind a single case of a murderer who has signed each of his victims in anything like this way. But there are, of course, serial murderers who have taunted the police and identified themselves by letters. The most famous example is Jack the Ripper, though the overwhelming majority of experts are now convinced that the murderer was not himself responsible for the letters which gave him his name. The Son of Sam letters named that particular killer or killers. But the man who was essentially known by his calling card self-identification, the man by comparison with whom James Buffalo Bill Gumb might be designated the Death's Head Killer, was the 1969 California killer known as Zodiac. This unarrested man, who killed 5 people and seriously wounded 2 more, got his name from the peculiar astrological mark with which he signed letters to the press in the first instance, a cross superimposed on a circle. His taunting letters revealed detailed knowledge of the crimes, which proved they came from the killer. To make assurance doubly sure, he enclosed a blood-stained piece of a victim's shirt with one of his letters, and he scrawled his mark on the car of one of his victims. A survivor told police that he had also daubed it on the black eye-slitted hood he wore. This man really did share Buffalo Bill's need to stamp his ego on each of his crimes in such a way that the public could recognize him. Crime enthusiasts recognized that he also inspired the film that gave us Clint Eastwood's classic phrase, "Go on, make my day." For Dirty Harry runs down a multiple murderer whose climactic crime is the kidnapping of a school bus full of children with the intention of killing them all, something one of Zodiac's letters revealed as his great ambition. The letters, killings, and even telephone calls stopped abruptly in 1971. And then the San Francisco Police Department received another letter signed with the zodiacal emblem and in the same handwriting in 1974. Thereafter, silence. Personally, I believe that the tubby, bespectacled young killer, for he was seen by survivors, was in jail for some other offence during 1972 and 1973, and was then incarcerated again during 1974. Certainly, rumours keep arising that he has been quietly identified as a long-term prisoner or asylum inmate somewhere in California, although the evidence, beyond a reasonable doubt, needed to bring him to trial, has not been found. On the other hand, there are more sinister rumours that he has started up again in New York, killing taxi drivers now, rather than courting couples, and leaving his familiar emblem. I suspect this may be a copycat. Zodiac did one more thing that links him with Buffalo Bill. In one of his earliest letters, there was a passage in code, which he claimed would show who he was. When disencrypted, this read, "I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest, because man is the most dangerous animal of all. To kill something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is, when I die, I will be reborn in paradise, and all I have killed will be my slaves. I will not give you my name, because you will try to slow down or stop my collecting of slaves from my afterlife." Now there is the authentic voice of a particularly nasty kind of serial murderer. Elliot Layton, the Canadian anthropologist, called his study of multiple murderers hunting humans. And Thomas Harris, has Agent Starling in Silence of the Lambs reflect of Buffalo Bill, he lived to hunt women. Robert Hansen was an unappealing physical specimen. Scrawny and spindly-legged, he owned a bakery business in Anchorage, Alaska. Married with a wife and young daughter, he was in his mid-30s when he started to combine the great outdoors life he enjoyed in his hunting cabin on the Kenai Peninsula with the indoor sport he performed less well with the hookers and go-go girls of Anchorage's red light district. Hansen had always rightly felt himself to be spotty and ugly. He felt sure the prostitutes he patronized must despise him. And he, in turn, resoundingly despised them. He emphatically believed in the simple division of women into the good and virtuous, whom he believed he treated with great respect and courtesy, though they probably saw it as patronizing and offensive male chauvinist gallantry. And the evil and sleazy whose services he bought and whom he despised for doing what he paid them to do for him. Ah me, how well Simone Weil has observed that a just God will not punish any prostitute in the next world for being a prostitute. The outrageous stigmatization virtuous society inflicts on them in this world is more than punishment enough. Yes, my decent church-going friends, many of us may yet find ourselves burning with Dives on the coals and pleading for a drink of water from the busty blonde or Miss Lashmore in Abraham's bosom. Robert Hansen was sure the prostitutes and strippers he lusted after were lower than dirt, and it enraged him that he should have to pay them for his sexual pleasure. They should be flattered and grateful that a decent bourgeois runt like himself permitted them to perform libidinous acts on his unlovely body. His anger boiled over into murderous rage in 1973, when he picked up a young, topless dancer called Joanna Messina at the dockside in Seward, Alaska. Joanna had come north after working in the topless bars of Seattle. She had heard there was work in the canneries of Alaska, and had decided to give factory life a whirl. When she arrived, she found there were no immediate vacancies. So she put in time again at the work she knew best, topless dancing and a little hustling. Hansen picked her up and took her to dinner. She had been camping out near Seward in the company of her dog, she told him. Hansen decided that she fancied him, and drove her out to a gravel pit, where he suggested that they might enjoy a sexual interlude. He was infuriated when the girl replied that he would have to pay. He shot her in the head, buried her body in a shallow grave in the gravel pit, then drove back to her camp and shot her dog. He felt that he had been entirely justified. Moreover, he found it extremely satisfying to punish a cheap whore for the impertinence of not fancying him. His next victim's identity was never established. A street prostitute, whom he picked up in his car and drove to dark and lonely Eklutna Road, she pulled a knife to protect herself when he demanded free services and became threatening. Hansen calmly took the knife away from her and cut her throat with it. He buried her beside the road, and when the body was found, the police were reduced to giving her the anonymous identifying name of Eklutna Annie. Two acquisitions, as his business prospered, allowed Hansen to step up the level of his punishment of prostitutes. He bought the Wilderness Cabin near the Knik River as a base for hunting mountain sheep. He became well known as a trophy hunter, especially skilled at shooting sheep with a bow and arrow. He also bought a Piper Super Cub airplane, fitted with outsized tires for takeoff and landing on snow, which could run him up from Anchorage to the wilderness at the drop of a hat. Now he had a really secure place to hold women and force them to do his will. Once he had got them on the plane and away to the distant peninsula, they might scream for help as much as they liked. They were in his power. Now he could tell them they must service him free and pretend to like it, or they would never return. Now he could threaten to use his social standing and local connections to have them run out of town if they refused to do what he wanted. Now he could enjoy the new pleasure of hearing them scream as he physically tortured them. Hell, they were only hookers, weren't they? At least 30 or 40 women succumbed to his odious blackmail. After hours, or occasionally days, of being raped and tortured in the wilderness, they promised to say nothing and were flown back to Anchorage, traumatized but alive. Those who were defiant, resistant, recalcitrant, were just shot and buried where they would never be found, except by the wolves and bears. It was Paula Golding who endured Hansen's discovery of a further form of pleasure. She was 30 years old and a secretary in a canning factory. Then botulism was found in some of the stock, and the plant was closed down to be completely cleaned and refitted. Paula found herself temporarily out of work. She accepted the only casual labour for women available in that place, and danced topless while she waited for canning to recommence. And in that short phase of work in the sex trade, she had the misfortune to encounter Robert Hansen and find herself forced onto his plane and up to the cabin in the woods. As a woman who had not made her way up through the streets, the attractive blonde was unusually resistant to Hansen's demands. That didn't stop him from enjoying 3 days of rape and torture, but it was quite clear that she was not a woman who would be open to his threats of blackmail. No law enforcement officers could run Paula out of town or charge her with prostitution. She wasn't a prostitute. and so the police would not offensively dismiss her protest that she had been a rape victim. Hansen's evil pleasure with this unfortunate lady was to turn her loose, naked in the woods. He was coming after her to hunt her down, he warned. This would be better sport than taking a bow and arrow to a sheep. Paula fled helplessly along the freezing Knik River bank. Sharp stones and pebbles cut her feet, but her only hope lay in putting as much distance as possible between herself and the disgusting monster who was following her with his rifle. But 3 days of torture and rape had weakened her. Adrenaline could push her off at the outset. Exhaustion overtook her in the end, and she staggered into some standing bush to hide, panting desperately. Hansen ambled after her, following the interesting trail of bloody footprints beside the Knik River. When they led into the stand of bush and he saw a flash of white in the undergrowth, he knew he'd found her. He shouted a hunter's whoop of recognition, and the despairing woman tottered out to make one last effort to run for her life. Hansen picked up the naked body and the cross sights of his rifle and brought his quarry down with a bullet in the spine. Now that had been real fun. He couldn't wait to repeat the pleasure of a naked woman hunt. Soon, 23-year-old topless dancer Sherry Morrow had joined Paula in a frozen grave beside the River Knik. And those are the victims who could be named, because their bodies were found and identified before Hansen had been connected with their murders. By his own admission, he had killed about 17 women, but he viewed them all with such contempt that he could only describe them as the one with the big tits or the one with black hair. The end came for this abomination when a 17-year-old hooker got away. He had picked her up and taken her back to the basement of his house with the promise of $300 if she would give him oral sex. In the basement, he persuaded her to take her clothes off so that he could fondle her breasts. And as soon as she was naked, he snapped a pair of handcuffs on her and chained her to a post. Then, stuttering with excitement, this man of unspeakable filth had the impertinence to call her filthy names. It was a prelude to beating and torturing her for a couple of hours. His wife was away, so he had the use of his own place for his revolting practices. Then he ordered her to dress, put the handcuffs on her again, and drove her to Merrill Airfield, where his trusty Piper Cub waited to run her up to the hunting field. The girl knew she would die if she went with him. The girls of the bars and brothels knew about the disappearances which had been going on for the last 10 years. They knew that, over and above the threat that unbalanced Johns always pose for hookers, there was some especially awful man preying on them. Rumours were being whispered from the 40 or so who had yielded to blackmail that there was a really evil punter about who took you to the wilderness and threatened to kill you if you didn't let him hurt you and ravish you. The 17-year-old was quite sure this guy would kill her whatever she promised, for she had seen his home and knew his address and could place him more confidently than her predecessors. As they transferred from the car to the plane, she made a break for it and ran sobbing out to the streets and into the arms of a policeman. Hansen was a great, big, brave, successful hunter man when he was behind God's back in the wilderness with a loaded rifle in his hand and a frightened and helpless woman before him. He was a knock-kneed, under-exercised, middle-aged bourgeois back in Anchorage, quite unable to catch up with a fleet-footed girl running for her life in a populated district. But he had the answer to having the whistle blown on him by a little tart. He rang a couple of respectable and prominent business friends, told them he was in a spot of hassle with a hooker. Would they help him out? Of course, they agreed at once. The average respectable citizen will instantly lie to wives and the authorities and the public when his or his friend's association with prostitutes is about to come out. Hell, they're only hookers. As D.H. Lawrence said, how beastly the bourgeois is, particularly the male of the species. Two prominent and respectable Anchorage businessmen happily confirmed that their old friend Bob Hansen had been dining and playing poker with them at the time when this dirty little girl falsely claimed he'd been kidnapping her. Shouldn't she be prosecuted for blackmail? Fortunately, the police were not convinced. They did not share the view that a teenage hooker was automatically more likely to be a liar than an upright burger. They couldn't bring charges, on her word, against that of the businessmen, but they could start a careful investigation of Hansen's world and property. And when more normal hunters uncovered the bodies on the bank of the Knik River, they could compare the bullets embedded in the naked women's spines with guns owned by the bloodthirsty baker. With that comparison made, the two businessmen who had given him an alibi were told a few home truths about perjury and obstruction of justice. They quickly gave up lying to the police, though since they had never actually sworn their statements, they were not charged with any offence. Pity, really. They deserved some public humiliation. They were, after all, so manifestly morally inferior to the prostitutes they despised. And with his lying supporters withdrawn, Hansen cracked at once. In return for an immediate sentence on four murders to which he would plead guilty, Hansen would give the police a full statement. Minimum publicity. It took the little creep 12 hours to complete his account of his own vile practices, and at the end of it all, he still seemed to hold the utterly mistaken belief that he was a more worthwhile human being than his victims. Thomas Harris's serial murderer, Buffalo Bill, is a self-conscious hunter of women. As he stalks Officer Starling through the darkness, using his infrared torch and night goggles, he reflects, "Would have been fun to hunt her for a long time. He'd never hunted one arm before. He would have thoroughly enjoyed it. No time for that now. Pity." But unlike the classic woman hunter Robert Hansen, Jame Gumb is hunting indoors, pursuing his quarry through a basement lair that the book Silence of the Lambs, more clearly than the film, demonstrates to be full of separate rooms, different torture cells, where varying instruments of torment lie, and where different women's bodies are preserved in lime, commemorating the tableaus of terror with which Buffalo Bill ended their lives. And that concept immediately calls to mind the unfinished saga of Leonard Lake and Charles Ng. That there was a saga only became apparent on the 2nd of June, 1985. On that day, San Francisco police arrested a middle-aged, bearded white man to whose parked car a young Oriental had just brought a stolen vice that he'd been observed shoplifting. The Oriental ran away and escaped. The white man gave his name as Robin Stapley and was found to be carrying a silenced pistol, a federal offence. As police prepared to take a statement from him at the station, he asked for a glass of water and swallowed a cyanide pill. Now, heavens to Betsy, that was going a bit far to avoid petty charges of receiving stolen goods and possessing an illegally silenced handgun. Dead man's fingerprints told a more elaborate story, however. He was not Robin Stapley, 26-year-old founder of the San Francisco Guardian Angels. He was an ex-Marine called Leonard Lake. After his discharge from the Marines in 1971, Lake had married. The marriage proved short-lived. His obsession with manacles and bondage, his need to photograph his partner tied up in humiliating positions, all proved too much for Mrs. Lake. Nor was she thrilled any more than his neighbours by his passion for military survival activities. Like Donald Nappy, the Black Panther, he collected militaria, dressed up in combat fatigues, seemed to be preparing for a lone life in a violent and hostile world where only some sort of John Wayne could come through. Despite his love of personal combat training, he had not seemed good military material to the Marines, however. They had discharged him for psychiatric problems after 2 years' treatment had failed to straighten him out. Lake took a succession of handyman or caretaker-type jobs, and he certainly was good with his hands. He bought a small, remote ranch at the foot of the Sierra Nevadas in Calaveras County. And behind the frame house, he excavated and constructed a deep bunker, covering it over with cinder blocks and burying it out of sight. It was to be his nuclear shelter, he said. He remarried in 1980. His second wife, Cricket Balash, found some, at least, of his eccentricities tolerable. She worked as a teacher's aide at a school, and she shared with her husband the peculiar belief that all children ought to know how to make explosives. It would be useful for ranching and farming kids, they argued, to be able to dynamite obstructive tree stumps from their land. The argument seems just as silly as the dreadful Dr. Edward Teller's claim that his revolting invention, the hydrogen bomb, would prove highly useful to humanity in changing the course of inconvenient rivers. It seems that brilliant scientists and loony janitors alike come up with peculiar claims about constructive earth-moving when they find that normal people don't share their dangerous and destructive small boy wish to make big bangs. Of course, the high school principal turned the lake's potty suggestion down flat. Nevertheless, Lake stockpiled arms and explosives himself, and in the early 1980s collected a couple of convictions for illegal possession of explosives and for stealing building materials for his bunker. Cricket Balash decided that a criminal husband was not for her and divorced him. I don't know whether she'd be confronted with Leonard's appetite for bizarre bedroom games or not. After this, Lake's closest associate became young Charles Ng, a wealthy ne'er-do-well from Hong Kong who had also served in the Marines. And while Ng had not been sent for compulsory psychiatric treatment, he had left a rather Lake-like reputation as a weirdo. He boasted of his great skill in the martial arts, sometimes claiming to be the reincarnation of a great ninja warrior. He hinted that he had killed at least one man. He was generally viewed with some reservations by his comrades in arms. He now spent a good deal of time with Leonard Lake, the young Chinese frequently wearing a T-shirt that read, "Mercenaries do it for money." And what mercenaries do for money? Killing. It turned out was indeed the way Lake enjoyed himself while with Ng. A surprising number of people, single women, single men, and young couples, had disappeared after making friends with Ng, or Lake, or both. That Robin Stapley, whose identity Lake had been assuming when arrested, for example, and his landlord and landlady. The reason for their disappearance emerged when police searched Lake's ranch house and bunker. The house contained a mess of weaponry and survival kit. Also, a lot of expensive video equipment, much of it stolen. Also, a large quantity of pornography. The bedroom was fitted out with manacles and harnesses and the general bizarre but not necessarily dangerous toys and fetishy dressing-up things of an extreme bondage and sadomasochism enthusiast. But a little closet with a two-way mirror leading to the bunker invited more serious consideration. It was stuffed with women's sexy undies. Was Leonard Lake also occasionally transvestite? Or did he invite his sexual partners to help themselves to dressing-up clothes and peek on them while they tried them out? Certainly the two-way mirror is one of the dodgiest of sexual toys, since its only possible use is for intrusive voyeurism. A trapdoor in this closet led to the bunker, and here things rapidly became worse. In the bunker's principal playroom, a large bed was fitted with eye-bolts so that an occupant could be spread-eagled on it. The mattress was covered with dark stains. Blood. The pornography held in the bunker was much more personal and much more sinister than the commercial stuff upstairs. Videos showed large numbers of young women tied to chairs and threatened by Lake and a young Oriental. They would have their clothes torn off them with a bayonet. They were visibly terrified, as Lake said things like, "By cooperating with us, that means you will stay here as our prisoner. You will work for us. You will wash for us. You will... for us. Or you can say no, in which case we'll tie you to the bed, we'll rape you, and then we'll take you outside and shoot you." The women, clearly not actresses nor willing participants, were shown being forced to shower with the young Asiatic. And then, sweet and clean for their ordeal, they were tied down and raped anyway, and sodomized, and tortured. Screaming faces flashing past the lens, could be identified as people known to Lake Cotton, who had mysteriously disappeared. Some of these victims were mere teenagers. And where were they? The discovery of a quantity of dumped bones and skeletons nearby supplied part of the answer. The pornographic journal of Leonard Lake supplied more. It talked of taking the men whose women he wanted, turning them loose in the desert, and going after them with a rifle, hunting humans. It wrote of his fantasy, partly inspired by John Fowle's novel The Collector, of having a collection of sex slaves in the bunker. It expressed his contemptuous attitude to women.
Women are like books. You put them on the shelf and take them down when you need them. You train them to do what you want. God meant women for cooking, cleaning house, and sex. And when they're not in use, they should be locked up.
One journal started with the remark, "Death is in my pocket, and fantasy is my goal." There can be little doubt that most of the women filmed by Leonard Lake met death. He had offered them the choice of compliance or rape and murder. Then, when they complied, brutally tied them up and raped them and sodomized them anyway. No doubt he then carried out the rest of his threat. He was no loss to mankind when he swallowed his cyanide. And what about his friend Charles Ng? Well, he escaped the pursuers who had seen him steal the vice, and ultimately made his way to Canada. There, another piece of incompetent shoplifting led to his arrest and identification. But Canada, which does not have the death penalty, does not willingly extradite criminals to countries where they might be executed. In the event that Ng is ever proven to be the young Oriental on Leonard Lake's vile home movies, and in the event that he is ever convicted of the murders with which the state of California wishes to charge him, Ng will become liable to take his seat in a chamber yet more lethal than that wherein Lake and a young Oriental friend strapped terrified teenagers to upright chairs. Not surprisingly, Ng's lawyers are fighting his extradition as hard as they can, and he has no wish to go back to California and have his face compared with that of the murderous rapist in the dreadful bunker of torture captured by Leonard Lake's camera. At present, in fact, Charles Ng is innocent until or unless ultimately proven guilty. John Fowles' brilliant novel, The Collector, has regrettably inspired not one, but two murderers. Leonard Lake enjoyed it and set out to imitate it. And it was the favourite reading, perhaps the only reading, of the Australian-American serial murderer, Chris Wilder. Wilder, after killing two young beauty queens near his home in Florida, started a mad chase across America to Colorado and back to New England in a sequence of stolen cars, abducting, torturing, and murdering beautiful young women as he went. His favorite kidnapping ploy, it was one he had used in Australia, was to appear with a camera, invite young girls to try out as photographic models, and having got them undressed, proceed to rape them. He held one girl as his captive for half of his long journey, using her as a decoy to attract others, and finally releasing her to her astonishment with a ticket back to the West. His particular preferred method of torture was to attach live electric wires to sensitive parts of his victims. One who survived also had her eyes and mouth closed with superglue. Most were killed and dumped in the desert or in canals and rivers. But what makes Wilder so interestingly analogous with Thomas Harris's Buffalo Bill is his use of television and videotapes to turn himself on before assaulting his victims. Buffalo Bill is described by Harris as watching a loop of his mother parading in a beauty contest and plunging down a chute into a swimming pool. This inspires him to go and torment the poor girls he calls the Thing as they lie trapped in his well. Wilder liked to play Jane Fonda aerobics tapes and make his victims copy the movements before he raped them. It gave him particular pleasure if their movements were enhanced by little shots of electric current. This monster shot himself, severely injuring and arresting policemen at the same time,
when he was finally stopped, close to the Canadian border. But the murderer who springs to everyone's mind when they think of Thomas Harris's Buffalo Bill is Ed Gein. Ed, the little old Wisconsin farmer, who also collected women's skins to make himself a bizarre fancy dress. Ed, of whom I once remarked, no one has ever dressed up as a woman the way Ed Gein did. Ed's unique hobby was exposed on the day the hunting season opened in 1957. Wisconsin in the winter months is drab and grey, and most of the countrymen look forward to the chance of getting out to shoot deer in the chilly woodlands as soon as they can. The little town of Plainfield was almost emptied of its male population on November the 16th, except for Ed Gein. The 51-year-old bachelor farmer never hunted deer. He couldn't stand the blood, he said. Couldn't take the butchery. Ed would never be willing to dress a deer, slitting it open and disemboweling it and washing out the bloody abdominal cavity. It would make him sick and faint. Ed restricted himself to shooting squirrels, which were a pest and not subject to a close season. Early in the morning, Ed's car drew up at Warden's hardware store. Mrs. Bernice Warden, 7 years older than Ed, was behind the counter as her son Frank was off in the woods after deer. Ed brought in a glass jug and asked for some antifreeze, which was on special offer. He paid for it, took it back to the car, and then returned into the shop again. A few minutes later, Mrs. Warden's big van screamed out of the parking lot at the back, laying down a considerable trail of rubber. A couple of hours later, Ed walked back to the shop and took away his own car, which had been parked there all the while. As he drove home, he passed a neighbour called Mr. Week, who had just shot a deer on Ed's land and was driving it proudly home, tied over his bonnet. His crest fell as he saw Ed, who was known to disapprove of people shooting on his territory, and had previously ticked Week off for doing so. Having taken his carcass home and hung it up, Week decided to go and apologize. To his relief, Ed was unperturbed. He himself apologized for not coming out of his garage to shake hands with Week, but he said he was pretty dirty from changing his car tires, taking off the studded snow tires. Week looked at the sprinkling of snow that lay on the ground, with more expected to follow, and wondered who but Ed would crazily have given himself that unnecessary work. But
It didn't strike him as unusual, for Ed was known as an eccentric loner. He had lived on the farm since he was 8 years old. His mother had brought him and his brother up there until her death during the war. Ed and his brother had gone on running the place until Ed's brother was killed in a marsh fire in 1946. Then Ed had taken it over, and the place had slowly gone to pieces. He didn't really farm it anymore, just sold off pieces of land to give himself pocket money. He did odd jobs as a handyman for neighbours, and might be called in by the local authorities from time to time to do casual work on the roads. He had no close friends, though the Hills, who ran the nearby grocery stores, were quite fond of him. He had babysat their children when they were little, and they sometimes gave him a meal. Neighbourhood kids found him affable, after the manner of lonely old bachelors. Sometimes he'd let them come into his house and see the collection of shrunken heads he said he'd bought in the Pacific during the war. When they told their parents about these weird objects in Ed's bedroom, the adults just smiled benignly. A farming and hunting community is less squeamish than a city suburb, and people were not persistently anxious about pederasty in those days. Even people who found Ed's oddities a little distasteful, like Mrs. Bernice Warden, put up with them uncomplainingly. For Ed, like his brother and mother before him, had always been a sound, if reclusive, citizen, patronizing the local businesses and paying his bills promptly. So Mrs. Warden bore with a sudden, rather creepy and misplaced flirtatiousness from the unshaven, but otherwise perfectly clean, elderly man. When he suggested that they might go dancing together, she just said their dancing days were over. When he suggested that they go and try out a new roller skating rink that had opened in a nearby town, she laughed at him. Ed said it was only a joke anyway. At 5 p.m, Frank Warden came home from the hunt. He had bagged nothing. He stopped at the petrol station opposite his shop and was surprised when the owner asked him why the hardware shop had been closed for most of the day. Frank hurried across, unlocked the door, and disclosed a scene enough to fill any son with anxiety. The cash register was missing. There were drops of blood on the counter where it had been. There was a large pool of blood behind the counter, and drops and smears from it running to the back door. Outside in the yard there were more traces of blood leading to the point where the van had been parked. And instead of the van, there was a trail of rubber screaming out to the road. Frank went back into the shop, where he found three receipts on the counter, the sole trading of the morning. The last was for antifreeze, and instantly Frank knew that Ed Gein had done something to his mother. Never, since P.C. Eli Nunn looked at Rose Harson's half-burnt body on the kitchen floor in Peason Hall, and on no evidence at all decided Gardner done it, has so swift a decision been made on so little evidence. Frank Warden was luckier than Eli Nunn, who caused an innocent man to face two inconclusive murder trials. Frank had a tiny bit of evidence, and his deduction was right. In the first place, Frank was aware of Ed's unwelcome invitations to the dance and the roller skating rink. In the second, he had been in the shop the night before, when Ed had looked in and asked if the special offer for antifreeze still held good. And he'd also asked, inconsequentially it seemed, whether Frank would be deer hunting the following day. Now here was a receipt for antifreeze. It didn't name Ed, but he had said he'd be in for some, and it seemed he'd made sure he would find Bernice alone. Last and haziest of all, there was some vague suspicion among local police that Ed might have had something to do with the rather similar disappearance of Mary Hogan, an elderly barkeeper, a few years previously. There hadn't been a shred of evidence to link Ed with her abduction and probable murder. There'd been blood spots on the bar. Most people thought her past and criminal associates in Chicago had caught up with her. But the police were very dubious about old Ed, and Frank was a former deputy sheriff. Quickly, calls went out to local police in Plainfield and neighboring townships. "Get your ass over to Plainfield," one officer was told. "There's been a murder here." Officers Chase and Murty drove out to Ed's farm to see if there was anything in Frank Warden's instant suspicion. Nobody was at home, but the back door was open. Murty looked in and struck a match, as he had no flashlight with him. The place was a mess, with piles of papers and rubbish lying all over the place. Fearing he might start a fire, Murty withdrew to go and look for a flashlight. He reported back to headquarters that Ed was not in, and officers Chase and Speece decided to go to the Hills grocery store and see if they knew where Ed was. They found Ed there in his car. He had been invited over for supper with the Hills, and then, when their son-in-law had looked in to say there was great excitement in town and Mrs. Warden had disappeared, Ed offered to drive the younger Hills over to see the fun. Chase asked Ed to give an account of his day and all his movements. Ed gave a rambling story, including his purchase of antifreeze. Then Chase asked him to repeat it, and after he'd done so, observed that Ed had changed some details. Ed thereupon said, "Somebody framed me." "For what?" asked Chase. "Well, Mrs. Warden." "What about Mrs. Warden?" "Well, she's dead, ain't she?" "Dead?" said Chase. "How do you know she's dead?" "Well, I heard it," replied Ed. "I heard them talking about it." He had given himself away. At that point, it was only known that she had disappeared. Sheriff Schley and Captain Schuforster decided that with Ed under arrest, it was time to go back and search his farm properly. There was no electricity, so they entered with flashlights. They found a rat's nest of bachelor squalor. Unwashed-up plates and old food lay around the place. There was litter everywhere. And then, in the summer kitchen, something brushed Sheriff Schley's shoulder. He swung his flashlight up, and the next minute he was out in the yard, throwing up violently. Hanging from a beam, with a sharpened stake driven through her ankles, was Bernice Warden's headless, gutted body. Her hands were tied to her sides, so that she could swing gently upside down without them dangling. Gentle old Ed, who was too squeamish to dress a deer, had less trouble in butchering a lady. He'd done a clean and thorough job, cutting away the head and neck with a neat V down to the collarbone, then starting the gutting incision well up the ribcage and carrying it in a good straight line down to the crotch, where he had carefully extracted the vulva and vagina, anus and rectum. The abdominal cavity had been washed. Now what on earth did Ed want with a well-butchered woman? Neighbours who had not previously realised that Ed never hunted deer recalled with horror that he sometimes gave away pieces of venison in season. Several people in Plainfield started to wonder just who they might have eaten over the last couple of years. A full search of the filthy house uncovered mounting horrors. Mrs. Warden's head was in a burlap sack. It had been prepared for hanging up among Ed's so-called Pacific trophies. 6-inch nails bent into hooks had been driven into the ears and a piece of string tied round them. Her abdominal organs were found in a bowl. Her heart was in a saucepan on the stove. Did Ed intend to eat a part of her? But the horrified police had only begun to uncover the peculiarities of Ed's house. They found a bag of noses. They found a bag of vulvas, one of them Mrs. Warden's. Another had been gilded with gold paint. When asked about this, Ed explained that it had started to rot and smell too bad even for his unfastidious tastes, so he had tried to preserve it by painting it. Mrs. Warden's private parts, on the other hand, had been thoroughly salted for preservation, and still they hadn't seen the half of it. There were old cane-bottomed chairs whose backs and bottoms had been ripped out and replaced with human skin. It looked quite a good job from the top. Inspection underneath revealed that it was not. The skin was badly tanned, with ridges of fat and flesh remaining. There was a lampshade of human skin. 4 skulls had been halved. Ed used 2 crania as soup bowls and ate his baked beans from them. The other 2 adorned his bedposts. And in the bedroom were Ed's shrunken heads. Not shrunken at all. Just the heads of recently deceased neighbours, all women, dug up from the cemetery. There were a couple of crude masks made from skin. There was a belt of nipples. There were puttees or greaves made from the skins of women's legs. And then we get to the bits that are really reminiscent of Thomas Harris's Buffalo Bill. There was a woman's black curly hair on its scalp for use as a wig. And you remember Dr. Hannibal Lecter's great explanation to Officer Starling of Bill's motive? "He wants a vest with tits on it." Well, Ed had one. Not beautifully tailored with fitted darts, fairly crudely cut straight off the torso of a woman. Like Buffalo Bill, of course, Ed had been careful to make the divide down the back, leaving the bosom he cherished uninjured. There were strings fastened to the back, so that Ed could put it on like a corset. It was tanned firmly enough to stand up on its own, but, shades of Buffalo Bill again, Ed wanted it to have some softness and flexibility, so it had been well-oiled. Not with the expensive skin creams Buffalo Bill forced the things in his well to anoint themselves with, but with good old 3-in-1 machine oil. And what did Ed do with this remarkable collection? Well, he looked forward to full moon. Then he would put on his scalp wig and a mask. He would tie his vest with tits on it round his torso, lace his female greaves to his legs. He would slip a vulva over his penis and hold it in place with a pair of panties. And then out he would go into his yard. And there, like the owl and the pussycat, he danced by the light of the moon. Not for too long, though. He said it all smelt too bad. The officers feared there was worse yet awaiting them. A part of the house had been carefully sealed off and boarded up, and what, they shuddered, might lie behind there. When they cautiously took down the barrier, they were amazed. 2 rooms, in perfect order, with no rubbish, no litter, no pieces of carrion, confronted them. Only there was a soft coating of velvety dust over everything, for these rooms had not been entered for 20 years. They were Ed's mother's sitting room and bedroom, lovingly preserved as an inviolate shrine since her death. Ed's mother. And the psychological monstrosity of this weirdo to end all weirdos began to explain itself. Mrs. Geen had been a firm, strict, prudent, and thrifty German-American. She'd brought her boys up to have strict moral standards. Ed used to repeat proudly the one great moral lesson he'd learned from her. If a woman's good enough for intercourse, she's good enough to marry. Thus did the sisterhood preserve each other's interest in using sexuality to ensure support without honestly practicing prostitution in the old days. But there was a less clearly spoken message which had also come through to Ed. Apart from Mama, women were dangerous. Sex was bad. The Geens didn't really go in for marrying much. There were several bachelor uncles. Bad women hurt good women by their promiscuous and self-interested exploitation of their sexuality. Best keep away from them. So at 51, Ed was still a virgin. I dare say even the Pope would rather he'd been a fornicator. When his mother died, he had tried to resurrect her at night, but failed. Instead, he started digging up other women as they were buried, and taking away pieces that increasingly interested him. He came to find the secret visits to the cemetery, the frenzied digging at night, sexually exciting in itself. He'd found a unique hobby. Yes, he had killed Mary Hogan. Well, she was a bad woman. Everyone knew it. And Ed knew some nasty gossip about Mrs. Warden. He believed that she had used her sexuality to steal Frank's father away from another girl who expected to marry him. The jilted maiden was said to have killed herself. That made Mrs. Warden a bad woman by definition. Both Mrs. Warden and Mrs. Hogan looked rather like the late Mrs. Geen. The rest of the collection had been lovingly assembled from 9 graves he had robbed. The authorities carefully opened 3 described by Ed, and found the mutilated corpses therein exactly as he had predicted. They didn't give themselves the pain of opening the other 6. It seemed Ed had told them nothing but the truth. Of course, he was obviously mad as a hatter. There could be no question of bringing him to trial. He was sent straight to the state secure mental home. But Wisconsin State Asylum for Criminal Lunatics prides itself on not being a soft option for murderers who beat the rap with an insanity plea. It's decisively enough secure that many of its inmates try to find legal means to get out. If, like Ed, they've been declared unfit to plead, and so never tried, they may clamour for a trial in the hope that they might just be found not guilty and have a chance of being released. So it came about that Ed did go to trial, 10 years after he had been incarcerated. It was a peculiarly academic exercise, costing the taxpayers thousands of dollars for no sensible purpose. For the doctors treating Ed gave it as their unanimous opinion that he was still quite mad and could not possibly be released.
but they added that he had improved sufficiently that he would now be able to understand the nature of the proceedings, and thus he was fit to plead, even though the only possible outcome would be his restoration to custody with a guilty but insane verdict. This strange charade had one very interesting outcome, for shrewd old Judge Robert Dolmar, sitting without a jury, reached certain private conclusions. He noted that, like Reginald Christie, Ed Gein never confessed to anything he hadn't been asked, and asked with firm evidence of his wrongdoing put before him. The judge reckoned that Ed, although undoubtedly nuttier and far nastier than a fruitcake, was also as sly as a fox, that he was covering up other murders. In particular, he was very suspicious of that marsh fire which had killed Ed's brother, for the two had been working on it together when his brother disappeared, and although Ed had been quite unable to find and rescue him as he heard his cries, he had no difficulty in bringing rescuers straight back to the exact spot where the body lay after he'd gone for help. The judge noticed that Ed stood to gain handsomely by that death, winning complete control of the farm, and the cash registers stolen from Bernice Warden and Mary Hogan showed that Ed didn't overlook the ways in which murder may satisfy avarice as well as lust and misplaced morality. Furthermore, there were a couple of travellers who had gone deer hunting under Ed's guidance and were never seen again. One of them had been flashing a big bankroll when he was last seen. But worse still, the judge noted certain evidence that not all of Ed's costume was put together from naturally deceased neighbours, for two of his collection of vulvas came from girls not more than 15 years old, and there had been no deaths of girls of such an age in the Plainfield neighbourhood. Ed Gein couldn't be squalider than we habitually think him, but it seems he was positively nastier. So far, we've been looking at the murderers who contributed aspects to Jame Gump, Buffalo Bill. But what about Hannibal Lecter? That brilliant creation, Hannibal the Cannibal. You may have felt, in thinking about Ed Gein, that Oscar Wilde was right, that art does a much better job than nature. For Jame Gump is entertaining, with his camp manner, skilled craftsmanship, and sentimental attachment to his miniature poodle. Ed Gein was merely sordid. Oscar's dictum holds even truer of Hannibal Lecter. Would that cannibal murderers could in some way add to the gaiety of nations by their penetrating intellect, perfect taste, wit, and stylish good manners. Alas, they're characteristically much stupider than the slightly above average sexual serial killers, as was the ghoul Gein. And America's best-known cannibal was a depressingly sordid character indeed. The name Hamilton Fish rings with a certain distinction in the USA. The Fishes took part in the American Revolutionary War, and that makes them hereditary aristocracy by American standards. The first fish to be christened Hamilton was named by a father who admired Alexander Hamilton, the Federalist statesman of the early post-revolutionary period. A Hamilton Fish was an important member of President Grant's cabinet, and in 1931 there was still an important Senator Hamilton Fish high up in the councils of the Republican Party. Albert Hamilton Fish was not so distinguished. Born in 1870, the son of a poor family, he was placed in an orphanage by his mother when his father died in 1875. Many children have bad memories of early institutional care and punishments. Fish had good memories. He remembered with great pleasure the teacher who used to spank them. While other kids feared and hated it, he loved having his pants pulled down and the hard hand whipping him on his bare bottom. "Nothing is greater than pain," he would say later, "if only it didn't hurt so much." Not that his masochistic pleasure in spanking meant that he was a happy child. Quite the reverse. He was a bedwetter. He was withdrawn and inarticulate. He tended to stammer. He feared other children and their teasing, and he especially hated his name Hamilton, which led to his being nicknamed Ham and Eggs. As soon as he could, he dropped it, and thereafter called himself Albert Howard Fish.
When he left school, he became a house painter. He was not especially good at it, not especially bad. Just an ordinary jobbing painter who made a living here and there. In 1898, he married. He was to remain married for nearly 20 years, a good and caring father to his 6 children. But his wife was rapidly disillusioned with him. In 1902, he served his first prison sentence, starting his criminal career with an unusually grand theft by the miserable and petty standards he was to establish for himself. He was working for a finance company as janitor and general handyman when he heard a conversation in the office indicating that the firm would shortly be going broke and ceasing to trade. That would mean his job was gone and everybody lost everything anyway. Why, wondered Fish, shouldn't he secure his own future immediately? He stole $800 from the office and absconded. It didn't take long for the police to catch up with him, and he did a couple of years in Sing Sing. By 1914, Mrs. Fish had had enough of him. She packed her bags and left, moving to another part of the country, and marrying a man called Straub, by whom she had another 3 children. Albert Fish remained attached to his own children, and they to him. His eldest son, Albert II, occasionally worked for him as a house painter. But by now, Fish's perversions were taking over his life. Most notably, he was a child molester. He would go out to work wearing overalls, shoes and socks, and nothing else. Then, if he could lure a child into a basement, he could be out of his clothes in a flash and back into them again as quickly. He learned fast that children rarely tell. With stupid, detached moralizing, he blamed 1 12-year-old girl whom he abused persistently for being very loose and said disapprovingly that he'd never seen anything like it. He was genuinely very fond of little girls in a quite normal and healthy way if they happened to be his natural daughters or granddaughters. He could be quite fond of them in a peculiar and unhealthy way if he'd contracted some sort of unreal relationship with them. For example, he contracted 3 bigamous marriages, apparently rather spur-of-the-moment short-term liaisons. One of them was to a Mrs. Myra Nicholas of Bartlett, Ohio, who had a daughter, Mary. Fish seemed very fond of the little girl, and years later, when he realized she would have reached the age of 18, he wrote to her, "So my sweet little girlie will be 18 on the 28th. I wish I could be there. You know what you would get from your daddy. I would wait until you were in bed and then give you 18 hard smacks on your bare behind." Apparently turned on by the idea, he then went on to share with Mary another new delight he'd discovered. "There is one of the largest pools in the U.S. in the Westside YMCA. Sometimes there are over 200 men and boys, all of them naked. Any boy or man can go in and see them for 25 cents. Not much use to Mary as a piece of information, though such voyeurism might have been healthier coming from her than from her short-term stepfather. But Albert's real preference was for boys. In particular, he interfered with little black boys. This was not because of a peculiar racial sexual interest, just the calculated and deplorable observation that the police made less effort to follow up complaints about interference with black than with white children. At one time, he even employed a little black girl to introduce black boys to him. His great dream was of castrating a little boy, but it seems that he never managed this. He did, however, abuse children sadistically, and he also startled children he was not actually abusing by beating himself in their presence. Mary Nicholas recalled that during the single week that his marriage to her mother lasted, he used to come in the evenings wearing only a pair of underpants and play a game called Buck, Buck, Hands Up with the children. They had to hold up hands with a given number of fingers showing. He guessed how many they were showing, and every time he got it wrong, they beat him with a stick. He had a paddle with nails driven through it to punish himself also. His bizarre activities were not exclusively sexual. Once his son saw him standing on a knoll where some boys were playing football nearby and screaming over and over again, "I am Christ! I am Christ!" Once his daughter found him sleeping rolled up in a carpet in the hall. Once he sprinkled lime and set a trap in the basement to catch a non-existent black cat. Often, before coming out of the lavatory, he would build a little pile of toilet paper on the floor and set fire to it. Once, when he left lodgings because the landlady had refused to whip him, he left little piles of excrement behind him in the bedroom. It was probably in 1926 that he ate his first person. He took a boy called Gaffney to a house on Riker Avenue, New York, that he knew because he'd once painted it. There he tied him up and gagged him after stripping him naked. He left the lad alone overnight, returning the next day with tools for cutting him up and a homemade cat-o'-nine-tails. He whipped the boy till he bled, cut off his nose, lips and ears, and probably killed him by pushing a knife through his eye. Then he stuck his knife in the boy's belly and drank the blood that flowed out. One of the most extraordinary and gruesome documents I have ever read is Fish's subsequent account of how he cooked and ate him, a real cannibal's cookbook that does not suggest a delicious feast. The feast that made Fish infamous occurred in the summer of 1929. 18-year-old Edward Budd wanted to get out of the hot and sticky city and put an ad in the New York World saying he wanted summer employment in the country. Mr. Fish answered it, representing himself as a Mr. Howard and saying he had a farm in Westchester County and he would like Edward to work for him. He visited the Budd family to make preliminary arrangements, apologizing for the fact that he had to go down to Jersey about the sale of a cow and would not be able to take Edward on for a week. During the week, he bought himself a butcher's cleaver and a knife and a steel. On his way out to the Buds the following week, he left his tools at a newsstand. And he bought some cottage cheese in a plain pot and some strawberries at a delicatessen. These were solemnly presented to Mrs. Budd as the produce of his farm. Now, it was occurring to Mr. Fish that Edward would be a bit big and difficult to dispose of. Moreover, he'd not really find him attractive. 12-year-old Grace Budd, who sat on his knee at table, was another matter. Improvising quickly, he told the Buds his sister had just such a child and she was having a party that afternoon. Perhaps Grace would like to go to it for a couple of hours. Then he'd bring her back and collect Edward for the journey to the country. The Buds were quite agreeable. Mr. Howard gave them a non-existent address in Columbus Avenue as his sister's house, and in his respectable, if rather shabby, three-piece suit, walked the child away. He picked up his butcher's implements, my tools of hell, as he later called them, from the newsstand. And he did not take Grace to Columbus Avenue. He took her a long train journey with a couple of changes, out through the suburbs, past White Plains, to an empty house in Westchester County. There he told the girl to pick flowers outside while he looked for his sister. In fact, he went upstairs and undressed. It was to avoid getting blood on his clothes, he told police at first, later correcting this to the fact that he liked being naked and wanted to expose himself to the little girl. When she came upstairs and saw him, she screamed that she would tell her mother. Mr. Fish promptly strangled her, complaining querulously 4 years later that she'd scratched and kicked him. Then he butchered the body, quickly and neatly. And then, with the table in front of him covered with human meat, he took a large swab of cotton wool from his pocket, soaked it in lighter fuel, and stuffed it into his anus. That done, he ignited it, and danced round the room, enjoying his own leaps and howls of pain, as his rectum singed, until at last he enjoyed a sexual climax. He seems to have been quite proud that he resisted ravishing his little victim. He wrote anonymously to her mother 4 years later, "I did not f*** her, though I could have had I wished. She died a virgin, but not to rest in peace." He took her arm back that day, chopping it into three pieces and stewing it with onions, carrots, potatoes and parsley in a pint of water with a bouillon cube, salt and pepper. Over the next 9 days, he returned to the house regularly to fetch back other joints until he had eaten Grace all up. Occasionally he varied his recipe by using strips of bacon, and he still enjoyed one cut more than any other. "How sweet and tender her little ass was roasted in the oven," he exulted. The police were baffled. The Budd family only knew Mr. Fish as Frank Howard, and no one had any idea where Grace had gone. Nor was it obvious why anyone should have abducted her, if not for sexual purposes. Although Fish was frequently pulled in by New York Police Department for petty thefts, for suspected child molesting, and for posting obscene anonymous letters, nobody connected him with the Grace Budd disappearance until, 4 years later, he sent that anonymous letter to Mrs. Budd. Since it gave an accurate description of the meal at the Budd's from which he had abducted Grace, the police knew this really was from their man. They now set about with some efficient detective work to trace him. The envelope in which the letter was posted bore the initials of a New York gentleman's club. It seemed unlikely that any of their members would be the semi-literate, perverse cannibal letter writer. But inquiries revealed that a porter at the club had filched some stationery and left it in the room where he'd ceased boarding a month previously.
to the rooming house hurried the police, only to find that the porter's successor, a Mr. Albert Fish, had also left. But the landlady assured them he would be coming back around the first of the month to collect money sent by his son. When he did so, detectives were waiting for him. When they told him they wanted to ask some questions about Grace, the shabby old man blearily nodded his agreement and thoughtfully took a razor blade out of his coat pocket. The police hastily confiscated it. There was one more surprise awaiting them when Mr. Fish had been charged and fingerprinted. An X-ray revealed 29 needles pushed into his body, 27 of them in the general area of the perineum, scrotum and rectum. One was a monstrous curved sailmaker's needle. Several had been inside him so long they had almost corroded away. Fish had inserted them himself. He offered various reasons. To enjoy the pain, certainly the most likely in his case. To purge himself of sin. He had developed a most peculiar religiomania, and he believed at times that he was required, like the patriarch Abraham, to sacrifice boys, like Isaac, to the Lord, or in the hope that the needles would make him bleed to death internally. Mr. Fish was obviously revoltingly mad. The distinguished psychiatrist, Frederick Wortham, said he was the most polymathic, perverse personality he had ever encountered, and claimed that he seemed to have practiced every single perversion Dr. Wortham had ever heard of. Actually, by my check, I can't find that Fish ever practiced bestiality. But it was deliberate omission on my part to spare your finer feelings that I made no mention of the part excrement and urine played in his diet. Despite this, his plea of insanity failed to convince the jury, who probably wanted this disgusting piece of moral detritus swept into the garbage bin as fast as possible. Albert Fish was sentenced to death by electrocution, a prospect which filled him with glee, as it should prove a greater-than-ever experience of mighty pain. It took two shots to kill him, and one newspaper speculated that his collection of perineal needles had shorted the system. This is often claimed, but in fact they had been removed while he was in prison, and Albert had been reduced to trying to replace them with a sharpened chicken bone. Now, that's what a real cannibal is like. Not the suave and sinister likeness of Dr. Hannibal Lecter, is it? Bottom of the heap depravity and utterly squalid mental demoralization seems to be the norm for Western cannibals. Not that I object at all to Thomas Harris's creation. It would be a far better world if cannibals were like Dr. Lecter. But don't go away with the impression that I would approve of cannibalism if only it were carried out tastefully. I will happily aver with Michael Flanders and Donald Swan that eating people is wrong.